This is a production of Cornell University.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you for joining us for Hillel's Einhorn Family Jewish Faculty Lecture Series. And this is the final lecture of the series. It's been really wonderful. We thank you all for coming. Our speaker this evening is Professor Richard Pollenberg, who is the Goldwin Smith Professor of American History. He received his BA from Brooklyn College and both his MA and PhD from Columbia University. He's authored countless books focusing mainly on modern American political thought. He is the recipient of many awards, including the Clark Distinguished Teaching Award in 1979, the 1979 American Bar Association Silver Gavel Award. That was in 1987. Professor Pollenberg has researched free speech issues, judicial practices, and is here tonight to speak with us about a more personal topic, the lives of Louis Brandeis and Benjamin Cardozo and the Jewish crisis of the 1930s. Professor Pollenberg.
Thanks very much, Ed. Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here. And when Ed Rosenthal invited me to give a lecture in this series, I confess I was a little bit worried. I've entered phase retirement, and I'm not teaching lecture courses much anymore. In fact, I haven't lectured for about a year or maybe even more. I'm teaching chiefly seminars these days. But whenever I worry, I remember a story about a well-known New Dealer, Harry Hopkins, a story about worry. You sort of think about it, it stops me from worrying. Well, he used to tell a story, Harry Hopkins did, about a girl who was going to go out on her first date, and she asked her father what she might expect. And her father said, well, daughter, that young man is likely to want to hold hands with you, and daughter, that's all right. And then that young man is likely to want to put his arm around your waist, and daughter, that's all right. But then that young man is going to ask you to put your head on his shoulder, and daughter, don't do that or your mother will worry. And the big day came and went, and the next day, father asked his daughter, well, daughter, how did it go? And she said, well, dad, it was just as you said. First he wanted to hold hands with me, and I said that was all right. And then he wanted to put his arm around my waist, and I said that was all right. And then he asked me to put my head on his shoulder, and I said, hell no, you put your head on my shoulder and let your mother worry. So when I think about that story, I tend not to worry anymore. I kind of stop, and I decided there really isn't any reason to worry. I'll just go ahead and talk about Louis Brandeis and Benjamin Cardozo, the first two Jewish justices to serve on the Supreme Court. Now, of course, today, we're used to having Jewish justices on the Supreme Court. There are, in fact, two of them, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer. What's interesting about them is that when they were appointed to the court, there was very little comment on the fact that they were Jewish. It was Justice Ginsburg's status as a woman that everybody commented on. She had made her career fighting against legal discrimination against women in the legal profession, but also in society at large, and that's what people commented on. You know, the interesting thing, as some of you know about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, is that when she applied for a clerkship on the Supreme Court in 1960, she was turned down. The justice whom she applied to and who turned her down was Felix Frankfurter, and obviously he didn't turn her down because she was Jewish. He turned her down quite explicitly because she was a woman and he did not want to have a woman serving as a clerk, as his clerk on the Supreme Court. And when Justice Breyer was appointed in 1994, the New York Times only comment was that it was interesting that Bill Clinton, President Clinton, had passed over the leading Hispanic candidate and had appointed another white male. That was the image that Breyer had rather than any image as a Jew. And how different it was when Louis Brandeis was appointed to the Supreme Court in 1916 by Woodrow Wilson, and even when Benjamin Cardozo was nominated to the court in 1932 by President Herbert Hoover. All of the comment then had to do with the fact that they were Jewish, or much of the comment had to do with that fact. There was a big controversy over Brandeis's nomination, went on for months, in fact, some of it based on strong feelings of anti-Semitism. Although that didn't affect Cardozo in 1932, nevertheless, the fact of his Jewishness was talked about a great deal. So it was the fact of their Jewishness the contemporaries thought mattered the most, and both of them actually remained towering figures in the pantheon of Jewish heroes. You know, both of them are known for their names, in fact, are synonymous with erudition. There is, after all, a university name for Brandeis and a law school name for Cardozo. And their names are also synonymous with excellence. When you think about Brandeis and Cardozo, you think about intelligence and judgment and knowledge and understanding. And this was revealed in a peculiarly oblique way in 1969 when President Nixon nominated G. Harold Carswell to the Supreme Court. And opposition developed on the grounds that Carswell was mediocre. Not that he was conservative, or he may have been, but that he was mediocre. He just didn't belong on the court. And one of his supporters, a Republican senator, Roman Hruska of Nebraska, said that, well, so what if he's mediocre? There are lots of mediocre people in the world, and they're entitled to some representation on the court, too. Aren't they? He might have said, we are entitled to, but he said, they are entitled to, aren't they? And he added the famous line, we can't have all Brandeises and Frankfurters on and Cardozos and stuff like that there. In any event, Cardozo and Brandeis both were known for their erudition and for their judgment and their importance in the law. They also evoked religious symbolism. Brandeis was always seen as the prophet, you know, and he was compared, the seeker after truth, the seeker after righteousness and social justice. And he was compared at different stages in his career with Daniel or with Jeremiah, but most often with Isaiah. And in fact, Franklin Roosevelt's nickname for Brandeis was Isaiah. You know, what did Isaiah have to say about that particular decision that came before the court was a comment Roosevelt would often make. Cardozo, by contrast, was not known as the prophet, but rather as the saint. The term saintly character was applied to him probably as much as any term was. He was such a gentle person, such a sensitive person, so saint-like in his demeanor. And in fact, his housekeeper, a woman who worked for the Cardozo family for decades and decades, said of him that he was, quote, more angel than mortal. And that seemed to sum up what people thought about Cardozo. So they had a good deal in common, Benjamin Cardozo and Louis Brandeis, but if they did, they also differed considerably in their outlooks, and those differences played themselves out in response to the crisis of European Jewry in the 1930s. And so in this talk, which is not going to take terribly long, what I want to do is sort of compare and contrast, as we want to do, and comment on and analyze the two justices' views of Judaism, then their reactions to Zionism, and finally their responses to the Nazi persecution in the 1930s. So that's sort of the outline. If there were a blackboard, I'd, you know, have it on the blackboard, no blackboard. But it's only 3 points, so it's not hard for me to keep in mind. At any rate, well, in comparing the views of the two men with respect to Judaism, there's a certain difference, a critical difference that emerges. Brandeis had never had deeply held religious beliefs, much less orthodox beliefs. He never had any reason to rebel against or reject Judaism because he'd never been imbued with Judaism as a religion. It just wasn't part of his upbringing or his life as a young or middle-aged, even as an older man. But there's a big difference with Cardozo. Cardozo, by contrast, did have an orthodox upbringing, and at a certain point, it's not exactly clear when, I'll try to indicate when I think it happened, at a certain point he rebelled against it. He made a decisive break with the tradition, not in terms of certain ways in which he lived, that is certain policies he followed or things that he did with regard to Jewish tradition, but with respect to his view of the religion and what it meant to him. So let's look at some of the differences between Brandeis and Cardozo when it came to Judaism as a religion. First, with respect to their religious training, Brandeis had no religious training at all. His parents were Jews who had left Prague and come to the United States after the failed revolutions of 1848, and they settled in Louisville, Kentucky. Brandeis, though, was not raised in a Jewish way. He had no religious training. He had no bar mitzvah. His mother, Frederica, thought that prayer and attendance at services were useless things. I'm quoting her now, "I believe that only goodness and truth and conduct that is humane and self-sacrificing toward those who need us can bring God nearer to us." So it was, you know, she talked about God, but there was no reason ever to attend services or be involved religiously in any way. And this is very different than Benjamin Cardozo. Cardozo's family was prominent in New York City Sephardic Jewish community. They were prominent members of Congregation Shiareth Israel, the Sephardic synagogue, the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue that had been founded originally in this country in as far back as 1730 by descendants of the Sephardic Jews who had emigrated to New Amsterdam the century before. The spiritual leader of the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue at the time that Cardozo was growing up and was a young man, even a middle-aged man, was Henry Pereira Mendez. He's the one who prepared Cardozo for his bar mitzvah. He used to speak about the three R's of Judaism: reverence, righteousness, and responsibility. That was the spiritual leader's outlook. Well, Cardozo was bar mitzvahed on June 2nd, 1883, when he turned 13. And, you know, you can, if you find the right book, go back and find what Haftorah was chanted on any given Shabbat in any given year, going pretty far back and also far into the future. And so we know, I found out, that the Haftorah he chanted that day was taken from Hosea. It concluded with a vision of the Messianic age when I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness and in justice and in loving kindness and in compassion. So there were two very different kinds of Jewish training here. Brandeis had none whatsoever. Cardozo had this kind of Orthodox training through the bar mitzvah. And they differed also not only with respect to that, but also with respect to religious observance. Louis Brandeis was not religiously observant. He didn't celebrate the high holidays even, but it's one thing not to celebrate the high holidays. It's another thing to celebrate Christmas, and that's what Brandeis and his family celebrated. His daughter remembers having a Christmas tree. The family exchanged Christmas presents. There's a wonderful letter that he wrote to his brother Alfred. His brother Alfred sent him a Christmas present, and Brandeis wrote, "There is great rejoicing." What was the present that his brother sent him? Well, what do you send for Christmas? It was a ham. And there was great rejoicing, Louis Brandeis said, when he received it. Well, there's, of course, a strong contrast with Benjamin Cardozo. For many years, he not only had an Orthodox upbringing, but for many years, he defended Orthodox traditions in his congregation, Shiareth Israel. At the age of 25, he made a speech to the congregation. The congregation was preparing to move to a new structure, the one it now occupies, actually, on Central Park West and West 70th Street. Any of you been to the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue there? Yeah, well, it's beautiful and very interesting kind of ceremony, that Shabbat ceremony there. In any event, they were preparing to move, and so some of the people in the congregation said, well, now that we're moving uptown to this new location, let's change the way we conduct our services. Instead of having the women upstairs and the men downstairs, let's have integrated mixed seating. And instead of having a kind of a cappella service, let's have an organ so that we'll have some music and really get things going. And wanted to make all of these changes. And Cardozo got up at a meeting of the electors, as they were called, of the synagogue to oppose the changes, and the changes were defeated. So as late as 1895, when he was 25 years old, Cardozo took an active role in defending the Orthodox tradition in the synagogue. At no point in his life, I'm sure it's absolutely safe to say, did he think of exchanging Christmas presents with anyone. That just wasn't Cardozo's way. And he continued to serve kosher food at home. If he went out, if he was invited out to eat someplace, at somebody else's house, he didn't insist on it being kosher. But in his own home, he remained kosher all his life. And so there's another difference between him and Brandeis. And they differ, too, with respect to their views of intermarriage. Not sort of poles apart, but there were subtle and important differences between them. Brandeis had no problem with intermarriage whatsoever. He accepted it quite casually. His brother, Alfred, the one who sent him the ham, married someone who was not Jewish. Louis Brandeis had two daughters, one of whom married a man who was not Jewish. In fact, he was the son of a minister, and Brandeis thought the world of him, that is of his son-in-law, called him a rare find. Brandeis married his second cousin, Alice Goldmark, in a civil ceremony. It was performed by his brother-in-law, Felix Adler. You know, Felix Adler, who was born Jewish and his father was a rabbi, was the founder, eventually broke with Judaism to found the ethical culture movement, and always remained a close friend of Brandeis's. And so he was the one who conducted a non-Jewish marriage ceremony for them. One of the biographers, one of Brandeis's biographers, I don't remember which one now, claims that his wife Alice converted to Unitarianism. Maybe she did, maybe she didn't, but certainly she was sympathetic to that view. Now, of course, as far as Cardozo was concerned, he never married. In fact, only one of his five siblings ever married. His twin sister, Emily, the only one of the six Cardozo children to marry, and she married a man who was a Gentile, and consequently, she could not, she was read out of the congregation, and she couldn't, when she died in the early 1920s, she couldn't be buried in the congregation's cemetery, in the Orthodox cemetery. I'll talk about this a little bit later on, but I just wanted to mention it now. In fact, the rabbi of the congregation wouldn't officiate at her funeral. Stephen Wise, the Free Synagogue, a friend of Cardozo's, officiated at his sister's funeral. Cardozo himself was willing to officiate, you know, when he was a judge in New York State, he could, of course, perform, or at any point when he was a judge at any level, could perform marriages, and he was willing to officiate at the marriage of a Jew and a Christian if it involved, as he put it, close friends or relatives. And even then, he admitted that it made him a little uncomfortable. Certainly wouldn't have made Louis Brandeis uncomfortable at all. And a final difference between them concerns their relationship to the Jewish communities in which they grew up and which they lived or didn't live, because Brandeis was completely uninvolved in the Jewish community in Boston, where he lived before his appointment to the Supreme Court. Not until 1905, when he was probably around 50, he was born in 1856, and figure it out, when he was nearly 50, did he give his first speech to a Jewish group in Boston, not a synagogue group, just a Jewish group that asked him to give a talk. And characteristically, what did Brandeis talk about? He talked about the need for assimilation. Here's a sentence: habits of living or of thought which maintained differences on the basis of religion were, quote, inconsistent with the American ideal of brotherhood. It was integration, not separatism, that he was interested in. And for the first 60 years of his life, there's no evidence that Louis Brandeis ever set foot in a synagogue. And significantly, when he finally did in 1916, it was during a Zionist convention in Pittsburgh. Well, I'll come to Zionism in a moment. But it was only through his involvement in the Zionist movement that Brandeis came to participate in Jewish life at all. Now, there's a great contrast, of course, with Benjamin Cardozo in this respect. He remained a lifelong member of Shiareth Israel. In 1914, when he was appointed to the Court of Appeals, the congregation congratulated him, and he replied that brotherhood, quote, is the tie that binds this historic congregation to all the members of our race. And years later, in the late 1920s, it was Cardozo who presided at a ceremony marking Mendez's 50 years of association with the congregation. So it's clear then that Brandeis, unlike Cardozo, had no religious training, was never observant, had no qualms at all about intermarriage, and had no congregational ties, and never then seemed to experience anything like the religious crisis of faith that Benjamin Cardozo did. Because Cardozo, despite all that I've said, and despite, you know, keeping kosher, you know, even throughout his life at home, Cardozo did not remain an observant Jew. He began to entertain doubts about Judaism and his commitment to it. He experienced, he admitted, a loss of faith. And his friend Rabbi Wise, who probably knew him as well as anyone, Rabbi Wise's wife, Louise, was also a great friend of Cardozo's older sister, who was an invalid much of her life. Rabbi Wise said that he was a, quote, hopeful, spiritual agnostic, and that probably explains it pretty well. So what explains it? What explains the loss of faith? You know, I'm really not 100% sure, even though I spent many years studying Cardozo and wrote a book about him. I think it may have had, and I admit that this is speculation, I think it may have had something to do with the reaction of members of the congregation when his twin sister Emily married a Gentile. He was very close to her, as twins are likely to be. She was the only one, as I've said, the only one of all the children to marry, and her decision must have caused considerable animus on the part of the leader of the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue, Mendez, who had actually written a play years before based on the story of Esther, which condemned intermarriage. And as we'll see, I'll mention this later, but I'll just say it briefly now, when she died in 1922, when Cardozo's sister died, twin sister died, she couldn't be buried in the congregational cemetery. It was Stephen Wise who would have to officiate at the service. It's not clear exactly when this change in Cardozo's outlook occurred, but it seems to me that it probably happened within a few years after he made that speech in 1895 about separate seating and at the new temple. In 1898, when he was 28 years old, and I think probably shortly after his sister married, Cardozo gave a talk on Benjamin Disraeli, an interesting kind of subject, of course, since Disraeli's family, like Cardozo's family, was Sephardic Jews, but his parents, Disraeli's parents, converted when Benjamin was 13 years old. Disraeli then renounced Judaism and championed the tenets of the Church of England and even said Christianity was a more perfect form of Judaism. But when Cardozo came to give this talk on Disraeli, he was quite sympathetic. While he didn't subscribe to Disraeli's views about Judaism, he nevertheless said that Disraeli was faithful to his race, if not his religion, that he took pride in his heritage, that he created sympathetic Jewish characters in his novels, and had done other things that aided Jews. And I think that Cardozo's sympathy with Disraeli at this point indicates that he was beginning to move far away from the orthodoxy that he'd grown up with. Certainly, later on, it was clear he had made this break. In 1931, Stephen Wise invited Cardozo. This was just a year before he was appointed to the Supreme Court, but he'd been chief judge of the New York State Court of Appeals for many years. In any event, Rabbi Wise invited him in 1931 to address the graduating class at the Jewish Institute of Religion, which Wise, you know, had started and was running, the Reform Seminary. And when Cardozo made this speech, he said he wished that he could say that he shared the beliefs of the graduates, that he wished he could say the devastating years have not obliterated youthful faiths. That's a quotation, but obviously the devastating years had obliterated the youthful faith. And so he instead spoke not about religion, but about values and how the meaning of life could be found in submerging oneself in the pursuit of an ideal. But he wasn't necessarily talking about a religious ideal. And in fact, by then, in private, Cardozo was referring to himself as a heathen, not a phrase I think that Louis Brandeis ever would have applied to himself. Because Cardozo, while he'd had an orthodox upbringing and remained close to that tradition through at least his mid-20s, had decisively broken with it. While Brandeis had never held religious beliefs at all against which he was going to rebel. He just wasn't but part of what he was brought up with. Well, let me turn now to the second point, that is the connection between these two men and Zionism, because again, I think we see an important difference between them. In Brandeis's case, his involvement in the Jewish community came about chiefly because, if not exclusively, because of his involvement in the Zionist movement. He began to show an intense interest in the idea of a Jewish state in Palestine in 1910. He joined the Federation of American Zionists in 1912. He moved into a leadership role in 1914, and he remained the leader of the Zionist movement even after his appointment to the Supreme Court until he broke with Chaim Weizmann in 1921. And while he severed his ties then with the Federation, with the Zionist Organization of America, he certainly remained a lifelong committed and dedicated Zionist. There are various explanations given for Brandeis's conversion to Zionism. Some people have said that it was coming in contact with Eastern European Jewish immigrants in 1910, before he was ever on the Supreme Court, when he'd helped resolve a garment worker strike in New York City. And the garment workers, many of them, if not most of them, were, in fact, most of them were Jewish and strong, Eastern European and strongly Zionist, and Brandeis's connection with them during the settlement of that strike may have had an influence. Philippa Strum, who's written probably the best biography of Brandeis, although it doesn't cover his Supreme Court years in as much detail as I would like or some others might like, nevertheless a very fine book, she attributes Brandeis's Zionism to the influence of the scholar Alfred Zimmern, who wrote a book called The Greek Commonwealth, which Brandeis read and evidently was evidently took to heart very seriously. Zimmern presented a view of an ideal society in the ancient Greek city-state, and he made explicit comparisons with Palestine and drew analogies between the two. And so Philippa Strum thinks that that book, The Greek Commonwealth, had a big impact on Zion, on Brandeis. There are other, many other explanations too. There are various people who might have influenced Brandeis. In any event, whatever the reason, by 1910, as I've said, he had become quite committed to all of this, and it became his passion. He gave a lot of money to the Zionist cause. In fact, between 1914 and 1921, he gave nearly $175,000 of his own personal fortune to the Zionist movement, and you know that's even a lot more by if we count it by today's dollars. Not that Brandeis didn't have it, he had the money, but he certainly was deeply involved in all of this. And when he died, one half of his residual estate, that is $1.5 million, would be given mainly to Zionist causes, the Jewish causes generally, but chiefly Zionist causes. And also Brandeis had an impact on the way in which Americans viewed Zionism. Jonathan Sarna, in studies that he's done of Brandeis, article that he's written about Brandeis, has noted that Brandeis assumed the leadership of the Zionist movement in the United States, and when he did, Zionism was seen by many, in fact by many Jews, as somehow un-American. You know, this was a dual loyalty. Either you're loyal to this country or you're loyal to some future state in Israel or to some Zionist entity, but it can't be both. And Brandeis played a large role in allaying those fears, and his eminence gave the movement a kind of legitimacy that it didn't have before he was associated with it. Brandeis always argued that 20th century American ideals, democracy, social justice, longing for righteousness were the same as ancient Jewish ideals. And so maybe his Zionism was more American than Jewish, but if so, it wasn't surprising because Brandeis was not a very religiously Jewish person, but he did make Zionism something that was more palatable and acceptable in this country. And then in 1919, you know, it happened. Brandeis went to Israel. Well, how many of you have been to Israel? Yeah, and how many of you remember your first sight of the city of Jerusalem? Right, well, how many of you kept diaries? Brandeis did, or wrote down in letters, you know, to his wife, what he said, and you know, those of us who can remember what it was like, that first glimpse, that first image of Jerusalem, can understand Brandeis as saying, it is a wonderful country, a wonderful city. It is indeed a holy land. He was overwhelmed by going there in 1919. And he was so moved that, you know what he did? Hard to believe, he actually went to synagogue in Rehovot. Yes, he did. And twice he attended synagogue in Zikron Yaakov. And he actually took part in the prayers that were being said in the synagogue. So you can tell that Israel, Palestine had a profound impact on Louis Brandeis. Well, after his appointment to the Supreme Court, he ended most of his secular involvements, although he still remained involved in the Zionist movement, at least until 1921, when he had this falling out with Chaim Weizmann. And he nevertheless remained firmly committed, passionately committed, to the creation of a Jewish homeland. Now, his view of Zionism contrasts very sharply with that of Benjamin Cardozo. As late as 1916, this is 10 years after Brandeis was head over heels in the Zionist movement, as late as 1916, Cardozo entertained doubts about Zionism, as did many other highly assimilated American Jews. You know, this was true right through up until about the time of the creation of the State of Israel. There was a strong sense on the part of many Jews in the United States that there was nothing for American Jews in the creation of a state of Israel, that in fact, insofar as it would mean that Jews would have a divided loyalty, it would increase anti-Semitism in America, and all the rest. In the summer of 1916, Cardozo was vacationing in New Jersey, where he and his sister often spent the summers, and he explained his view to a friend who wrote about this in a letter that I found in one of the archives. He said that he remembered Cardozo's exact words as the two of them were walking up Fifth Avenue sometime around 1916. Cardozo said he didn't see, quote, how it would help me in walking up Fifth Avenue in New York if there were a Jewish state in Palestine. You know, what difference is it going to make from the standpoint of an American Jew? It's just not going to matter. His friend, who in fact was a Zionist, argued with Cardozo, but to no avail. But 2 years later, in 1918, Cardozo accepted Zionism, but he was never fired with the same enthusiasm that Louis Brandeis was. He was always lukewarm in his attitude. Rabbi Wise, Stephen Wise, was seeking recruits in 1918 for the Zionist Organization of America, and he knew Cardozo, and he found Cardozo was more sympathetic than he'd expected to be, and he sent him a membership form, and Cardozo signed the membership form, as he said in a letter to Wise, quote, with some misgivings, because he was not as yet, quote, an enthusiast. But he said, you know, it's you're either going to be supportive or you're going to be an opponent. And given that I don't want to be an opponent, I therefore, you know, unenthusiastically will be a supporter. And Wise replied, kind of tongue-in-cheek, that he would not be asking Cardozo, quote, to make any addresses in Yiddish, seeing that you state English is preferred by you, which was kind of a recognition that Zionism drew its strongest support from Eastern European, Yiddish-speaking immigrants to the United States, rather than from the old either Sephardic community or from German Jews, who had, of course, come to the United States earlier than the Eastern European Jews. When Wise asked Cardozo's permission to publicize the fact that he had signed on, because at this point Cardozo was prominent. He was a member of the New York State Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in New York State. And when he asked permission to publicize the letter, Cardozo agreed, but he noted that his own words, Cardozo's words, did not sound to me like a bugle call, but it might help for others who are laggards like myself, that is people who are reluctant to associate with a Zionist movement. Well, in the years that followed, Cardozo took part in Jewish organizational life. He became a member of the Executive Committee of the American Jewish Congress. He even served on the Board of Trustees of the Hebrew University in Palestine. But he never took an active role in Zionist affairs, nothing like the role that Brandeis took. He never visited Palestine, unlike Brandeis, you know. He wrote a handwritten draft of a speech in his papers, which most of which are at Columbia University. Many were destroyed after his death, but the ones that survive are in Columbia University. And there's a speech there that he intended to give at the opening of the School of Jurisprudence at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. This was going to be in 1928. So he clearly was planning to go to Jerusalem in 1928 to make this speech, but he didn't go. And it's unclear why he didn't go, but my guess is that he stayed here in the U.S., well, partly because he hated to travel. I mean, I don't think that he ever took an airplane trip anywhere. I think all of the travel that Cardozo did, you know, even, and he, you know, lived until 1938, all the travel he ever did was by train or by automobile. But his sister, his older sister, for whom he was caring, was in very, very bad condition by the fall of 1928, and probably he stayed back just in order to be with her and not leave at a crucial time. In any event, he never did have the experience Brandeis did of going to Palestine and seeing what it was like. So there's nothing in his reaction, even when he joined this organization back in 1918, to indicate that he felt anything like the commitment to Zionism that Louis Brandeis felt. Just was, you know, different. So there are their attitudes toward Judaism and toward Zionism. And let me turn to the last thing I want to talk about, which is the crisis of the 1930s and see how these views played themselves out. Now, of course, both Brandeis and Cardozo knew that anti-Semitism existed in America, and both of them were horrified and were appalled by the existence of it, and they resented the least manifestation of anti-Semitism. It doesn't appear that anti-Semitism had hurt their own careers. Brandeis, of course, had a brilliant career at Harvard Law School and then made a small fortune, large fortune, as a Boston attorney. And Cardozo had an equally brilliant career at Columbia Law School and as an attorney, and then was appointed to the New York State Court of Appeals when he was only 44 years old. Now, it's true that some of the opposition to Brandeis's appointment to the Supreme Court in 1916 was based on anti-Semitism, but not all of it. A good deal of opposition was based on the fact that Brandeis was a reformer and that Brandeis wanted to regulate banks and insurance companies, and had written a book called The Money Trust, which attacked large financial and corporate institutions. So he was not only Jewish, he was also, from the standpoint of some conservatives, much too radical in his outlook. And Cardozo didn't know this, but back in the early 1920s, when his name had come up as a possible appointee to the Supreme Court, there were sentiments expressed within the administration, the Republican administrations at the time, that you couldn't appoint him because he was Jewish and this would be a second Jew on the Supreme Court, although this isn't something that Cardozo knew anything about. Cardozo, though, was so refined and cultured. I mean, Cardozo, one of the only languages he didn't speak was Yiddish and maybe Hebrew. He knew Greek, he read Greek, he read Latin, he read French, he read German. I mean, you know, he was a very, very cultured man. In fact, so much the case that when friends of his who were Protestants wanted to break down barriers to Jews in places like the Century Club or other private clubs, they would nominate Cardozo because he was so refined, so elegant, in a way so non-connected to stereotypes of Jews that were common at the time. So it must have been a shock to Brandeis and Cardozo, more of a shock to Brandeis because Cardozo would have known about this and Brandeis may not have, when on joining the Supreme Court, they encountered Justice James McReynolds, who'd been appointed by Woodrow Wilson back in 1913. And James McReynolds was a bitter anti-Semite. He hated Jews, Hebrews, as he called them, the Orient, he called them, simply for the fact that they were Jews, and he made his hatred known. Now, it wasn't, you know, that they were the only people he hated. He hated blacks, he hated women, I mean, at least insofar as they thought that they had any rights that he had to respect. And he refused to attend court dinners at which Brandeis, you know, dinners for the Supreme Court at which Brandeis or later Cardozo would be present. And when Cardozo was appointed to the court and was sworn in, McReynolds, you know, ostentatiously had his nose in a newspaper, wasn't paying any attention to the swearing-in ceremony of a fellow justice. Cardozo's father had run into many legal difficulties back when Cardozo was a child, back in the 1870s, partly because of his connection with the Tweed Ring, charges of corruption, some of which may have been legitimate. And Cardozo's father had to leave his position as a judge in New York City and just continue practicing as a lawyer as a result of the scandal. And that is the background to McReynolds' comment when Cardozo was appointed to the Supreme Court. Seems the only way you can get on the Supreme Court these days is to be either the son of a criminal or a Jew or both. That was James McReynolds' comment. Harold Lasky, the British scholar, you know, and who was a great friend of Brandeis's, said McReynolds and the theory of a beneficent deity are quite incompatible. and is probably right. Anyway, both men, of course, Brandeis and Cardozo, were outraged by Nazi persecution of the Jews after 1933. Privately, they expressed their dismay. Cardozo spoke about, quote, the Hitler horrors. Brandeis said, the Germans are outdoing themselves in brutality. But the question was, what public position, if any, would Brandeis or Cardozo take with respect to what was happening in Germany? And here it was Brandeis, the Zionist, but not the person with any Jewish upbringing, who took a more forthright line than Cardozo. And this is illustrated very nicely by an incident that's not very well known, but it's never that was known at the time, and I want to just talk about it for a minute or two, the so-called Bremen incident in New York in 1935. The Bremen was a German passenger liner, and of course, 1935, Hitler was in power, the Nazis were in power, but the Bremen docked in New York City to drop off passengers and pick up passengers, and it flew a German flag with a swastika superimposed on it. And so in 1935, there's a German ship with swastika flying in the harbor of New York City, and it was planning for a departure, and the departure was going to be at midnight, you know, like a big event, bands playing, you know, food galore, midnight sailing of the Bremen. And as the passenger ship was readying to depart, a number of radicals, in fact, they were communists, who at this stage were in a kind of anti-Nazi phase. Later, after the Nazi-Soviet Pact in 1939, American communists would not be so anti-Nazi, at least until the Germans attacked the Soviet Union in 1941. But in 1935, they had the right point of view. They were anti-Nazi, and so they sneaked on board. They stormed the deck. They climbed up the mast or whatever. They ripped down the Nazi flag and they dumped it overboard. And then the police and begin to scuffle with them, as do the crew, the German crew. And five demonstrators were arrested and charged with unlawful assembly. And one of them, a sixth, was actually held for assaulting one of the police officers. So now these five radicals who had been part of this anti-Nazi demonstration are going to come to trial for unlawful assembly or disorderly conduct. And they appear before a Jewish judge, a magistrate. His name is Louis Brodsky, not a high-ranking guy, just a magistrate in the New York court system. And he renders a decision. You know, he hears the evidence, there's no jury or anything, and he renders a decision and he dismisses the unlawful assembly charges. And he writes an opinion which very deftly inserts his anti-Nazi views into it. It may well be, I'm kind of quoting, part paraphrasing, it may well be that flying the swastika in New York Harbor was rightly or wrongly regarded by the defendants as a gratuitous flaunting of all that was antithetical to American ideals and as equivalent to, quote, the black flag of piracy. And since no conspiracy had been proven, you know, it was a legal issue, did these people conspire to do this? Since there was no conspiracy that could be proven, he dismissed the charges and set the defendants free. Well, Hitler's government was outraged, as you might expect, and they issued a protest. And to his everlasting discredit, Secretary of State Cordell Hull, whose wife, by the way, was Jewish, Cordell Hull issued an apology to the Nazi government, saying the magistrate Brodsky's language could give the impression he was going out of the way to criticize Germany and that's something that he shouldn't have done. 1935, the Nazis are holding their convention in Nuremberg, you know, the famous Nuremberg Convention, and the German Minister of Justice gets up and he says he had protested against, quote, the characteristic Jewish impudence, end quote, of Brodsky, and he made other typically disparaging Nazi-like remarks. So that's the event in 1935. Now, Cardozo had no reason, Benjamin Cardozo is, you know, then on the Supreme Court, Cardozo had no reason to comment publicly on the affair, but privately, he expressed his dismay. And who did he express his dismay at? At Brodsky, at the Jewish magistrate who he thought had misused his judicial office to denounce Nazism. He called Brodsky's statement a, quote, shameful utterance. Get that. A shameful utterance, a lapse from the standards, from the, quote, standards of judicial propriety that must be upheld. It would have been bad enough if a Gentile judge, magistrate, had said something like that. And I'm quoting Cardozo, but for a Jew, it was unforgivable. Now, you know, in the narrowest, most technical sense, Cardozo maybe was right, that Brodsky shouldn't have done that. But in a larger, broader, ethical, moral, humane sense, Cardozo could not have been more wrong. Fortunately, it was a private letter that he wrote all of this into, actually to his cousin, not something that he said publicly, but it indicates just how cautious and careful Cardozo was about these things. And that wasn't the view that a Louis Brandeis had. I don't have any way of knowing how Brandeis reacted, if he did react at all, to this incident. He was in Washington at the time. He didn't have roots in New York. He may not have commented on it. But we do know how Rabbi Stephen Wise reacted to all of this. Even though he was Cardozo's friend, he reacted quite differently. And we know about Wise's connection with Louis Brandeis. Stephen Wise was in Palestine when the Bremen incident occurred. A few days later, his boat docked in New York City. You know, it was great. In those days, when any mildly famous or well-known person returned to the United States, the newspaper reporters would be there with their flash bulbs, you know, and they'd get an interview. They'd want to know, well, what did you do, and what do you think about this, and what do you think about that? And so there were newspapers reporters there to interview Stephen Wise. And what did you think, they said, of Magistrate Brodsky's statement? Wise replied he would, quote, not insult the flag of pirates comparing it to the swastika. He soon thereafter delivered his, and this was in September of 1935, so a few days later, a week or two later, he delivered his Rosh Hashanah sermon at the Free Synagogue. And in it again, he talked about that incident. He said that the horror of the Nuremberg Nazi Party rally was made worse by the U.S. government's and Cordell Hull's abject apology for Brodsky's utterance. Especially, he said, it made it worse because the United States had not, to that point, uttered a single word of criticism of Nazi persecution of the Jews, which surely existed by 1935, if, of course, it hadn't gone as far as it was to go a few years later. And again, he reiterated the notion that the word pirate was too good a word to apply to the Nazi regime. Well, I haven't come across any indication that Wise ever discussed the Bremen incident with Cardozo, who, after all, was a good friend. But he was always critical of Jews who rejected his call for a boycott of German-made goods on the grounds that you don't want trouble and that this would increase anti-Semitism. He referred to them as the shh-shh Jews, Jews who don't want to stand up for anything and say what they think. And although he had great personal admiration for Cardozo and was a good friend of Cardozo's, when he was seeking moral support for the anti-Nazi campaign, he wanted a boycott of Nazi-made goods, he turned to Louis Brandeis, not to Cardozo, who in fact had supported Wise's idea of a voluntary boycott, and who, after Wise had organized one of the earliest anti-Nazi demonstrations, a large, huge Madison Square Garden rally, Brandeis told Wise, that he should continue his efforts because no one could have done a finer piece of work. So there are Brandeis and Cardozo's views of Judaism and of Zionism and of the beginning of the crisis regarding Nazism in the 1930s. And let me just conclude briefly with a few comments. Neither of these men lived long enough to see the full horrors of Nazism. Maybe it was fortunate that they didn't, and certainly not the concentration camps. Cardozo was felled by a heart attack in December 1937. This was followed by a stroke the following month, and he lingered until July 1938, when he died at the age of 68. But he never sat on the Supreme Court again after December 1937. He was not in good enough health to do it. Brandeis resigned from the court in February 1939, shortly after he too had had a heart attack. And he lived until October 1941, so he died 2 months before the U.S. entered World War II. Brandeis at the age of nearly 85. You know, in death as in life, the differences between them were nevertheless apparent. Brandeis, as you might expect, did not have a religious funeral, a religious ceremony at his funeral. It was a secular funeral service. He left instructions for the playing of Beethoven's string quartets. The only eulogy that was given by one of his former law clerks, Dean Acheson, who of course would later, years later, become Secretary of State. His body, not quite in accordance with Jewish law, was cremated. And a year after the cremation, his ashes were placed in an urn. And a year after the cremation, they were finally buried where beneath the law school building at the University of Louisville. Well, Cardozo, of course, had an Orthodox religious service, and it was held at the home of his friend Irving Lehman, where he had spent his final months. The cantor from Shiareth Israel presided over a brief 10-minute service. The service was completely in Hebrew. There were many people, Eleanor Roosevelt, many people attended the service, and some of the people who were there were upset that there wasn't a word they could understand at the service. They, of course, included the reading of the 23rd Psalm and selections from the Book of Proverbs. At Cardozo's request, there was no eulogy at all. Then the funeral cortege went out to Cypress Hills Cemetery in Queens. The mourners recited the Kaddish. The coffin was lowered to its final resting place next to Cardozo's mother and father and his brother and all of his sisters, except his twin sister, Emily, who, as I said earlier, had married a Gentile and so, according to Orthodox Jewish law, could not be buried in sacred ground. Far from denying any aspect of their Jewish heritage, both Brandeis and Cardozo were proud of who they were, and they were proud of their ancestral traditions. They're both, I think, properly seen as liberals on the Supreme Court, liberals when it came to social and economic policy, liberals in that they recognized the law must change and adapt to changing social realities. As Cardozo once famously put it, the final cause of law is the welfare of society. Yet there were nevertheless important differences between them, because Brandeis, who was not at all a religious person, nevertheless was a passionate, a devout, you might say, Zionist. And Cardozo, who eventually moved away from the Orthodox beliefs of his youth, always remained cool, or at best lukewarm in his commitment to Zionism. And when it came to their reaction to Hitlerism and at least the early stages of Nazi persecution of the Jews, it was Brandeis who took the more courageous and forthright stand, and in fact took the more realistic stand. And it was Cardozo who, in retrospect, and even to people at the time who knew about it, seemed timid and defensive. Well, I don't know what would have happened if they had lived beyond Pearl Harbor, beyond December 7th, 1941. I like to think that if Cardozo had lived beyond that, that after the U.S. entered World War II, he would have moved closer to Brandeis's outlook. After all, in his first book, published in 1921, The Nature of the Judicial Process, he had discussed what he called an old legend. It was actually a Talmudic legend, though he didn't identify it as such. The legend holding that on one occasion God prayed, and his prayer was, "Be it my will that my justice be ruled by my mercy." That was a lesson, Cardozo said, that judges ought to take to heart. And I wish actually that he had followed his own advice and had taken that to heart during the crisis of the 1930s. Had he done so, his position would have been closer to that of Louis Brandeis's and I guess Rabbi Wise's also. Thank you very much. So, if you have any questions, comments, or anything else, I'll be glad to try to answer any questions. Yes?
How much did Louis Brandeis's approaches to Judaism affect the founding of Brandeis University after his death?
It's a good question. I don't think that Brandeis's own outlook on Judaism was something that the founders of Brandeis took into account when they decided what kind of university it would be. What they took into account was the bequest and the money that would be available in order to do this. And that's not a wrong thing to do. But I don't know to what degree, if any, Brandeis's own outlook on any of this got written into or adopted, applied by Brandeis when it was created. But it just is, I mean, there are law schools and universities named for other judges. It was Sandra Day O'Connor was here last semester, and there's now the law school, one of the law schools has been renamed in her honor. So this is not unheard of. But for a while, I think Brandeis and Cardozo were the only two justices who had institutions of higher learning named for them, and which was, I think, appropriate.
You mentioned earlier that Cardozo's father had gotten into some legal trouble when he was a judge. Do you think that this influenced, Cardozo's behavior, either both as a judge and sort of as how he should project himself as a Jew in the public life?
I'm not sure about how projecting himself as a Jew, but I think certainly it influenced how he thought about his image as a judge. Cardozo's father, it's a complicated story. I've written about it in my book on Cardozo. His father was a judge in New York City, and as such, he was able to send business to certain people. You know, issues would come before the court, and you'd have to send it to a lawyer and the lawyer would be paid for it. And he sent a huge number of cases to his nephew, Gratz Nathan. And evidently, Gratz Nathan paid his Albert Cardozo, the father, for doing this, because, you know, Nathan would make a deposit, would make a withdrawal of $7,526.37 from his bank, and Cardozo the next day would deposit $7,000, maybe not the 37 cents, in his own bank. And so there was a clear pattern of him sending work his nephew's way, and the nephew then making paybacks. And there was a whole hearing that was held. Cardozo wasn't the only one. There were two or three other judges who were accused of being corrupt. And Cardozo, in order to avoid what was certain condemnation, resigned his judgeship, and in fact seemed to promise that he'd leave New York City, but he didn't do that. He just continued a law practice in New York City. This happened when Benjamin Cardozo was just a child, and so he learned about it later on. There were people in the Cardozo family who felt that the father had been treated badly, that there were trumped up charges, that he wasn't really guilty. I think that's probably going too far. I think that he probably had done most of the things he was accused of doing. But Cardozo was certainly aware of his father's reputation, even though he appeared to defend him. That is, he never publicly admitted that his father had done any wrongdoing. And what Cardozo took from that was a sense that he had to remain clear of politics. He was very, very cautious about any kind of political involvement, making his political feelings known, supporting a candidate, even inviting a senator to come to his swearing-in ceremony, a senator who had supported him, because it might seem that he was showing favoritism to that point of view. So when relatives said, you know, can you contribute money to this good, sort of worthy cause? Well, you know, he said a judge has to be very careful about making any kind of a commitment to anything that's might ever be construed as the least bit partisan. So Cardozo, you know, went as far as he could to steer clear of anything like this. And so I think that's what, you know, the impact that his father's disgrace had on him, that he tried to remain as, you know, as far removed from politics as he could be. And in that sense, you know, I think that the person who is the exact opposite, the polar opposite of Cardozo, here's a question, you know, which Jewish justice on the Supreme Court was exactly the opposite of Cardozo? Abe Fortas. You know, Fortas, who even after he was appointed to the Supreme Court, continued giving advice to Lyndon Johnson, met with Johnson and his advisors, urged them to escalate the war in Vietnam, let Johnson know, if necessary, what business was being transacted at the Supreme Court, you know, in advance. I mean, it was disgraceful what Fortas did, and it was exactly the opposite of the position Cardozo took. Well, thanks. Yes.
Did they have a personal relationship, the two of them?
Oh, yes, they did, certainly. Not very close before Cardozo was appointed to the Supreme Court, but when Cardozo was appointed to the Supreme Court, you know, he'd lived his whole life in New York, Cardozo. He was a bachelor. He lived with his sister in New York City until her death in 1929, I think. And then you know, in Albany, he had his own place, you know, to stay. When he was moving to Washington, it was a big step, you know, getting out of New York City after all of these years. And it was, I think, Rabbi Wise's wife, if I remember correctly, who wrote to Brandeis asking if he wouldn't kind of take Cardozo under his wing and sort of, you know, help him out down there. It doesn't appear that they had a very close relationship on the court. That is, there's not a lot of correspondence between them. They didn't seem to consult with each other a whole lot. They usually, though not always, voted the same way. On many issues they did, on some issues they didn't. Cardozo was much stronger on issues of crime and law and order. He was actually quite conservative on those issues, more so than Brandeis. So they didn't always see eye to eye. They remained just colleagues on the court. Brandeis's great friend on the court was Oliver Wendell Holmes while Holmes was on it. I mean, Holmes and Brandeis, you know, were like that, and they often were found on the same side of an issue. That can't be said of Cardozo and Brandeis, but they served, after all, from 1932 until the end of 1937, when Cardozo no longer could carry on his affairs. So during those 5 years, they had a, you know, a friendly and a civil relationship. The one thing they had in common was that they could share their views of James McReynolds, if nothing else. But it is interesting, you know, two Jewish justices on the court, and then that wouldn't happen again until from the 1930s, that wouldn't happen again until the 1990s. And of course, after Fortas's resignation, really forced resignation, in 1969, no Jew was appointed to the court until Ruth Bader Ginsburg in 1993. There's a long hiatus there. Okay, thanks folks very much. I appreciate you coming out.